that's it for the show. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great week. It's Sean Watson. I'm listening to WRCT.org or 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh.
The majority of U.S. Army bases on the continent were initially outposts for wars against indigenous nations. Fort Snelling, Hayes, Kearney, Leavenworth, Sill, and Riley, all named after U.S. Army officers who commanded genocidal wars. For most of the period from the U.S. War of Independence to 1890s, the sole function of the U.S. military was to kill, round up refugees, relocate and confine Native Americans, and appropriate their land and resources to replace with Anglo-American settlers.
That's Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz on an indigenous people's history. The history of the United States is one of settler colonialism. The state was established on the basis of white male supremacy, slavery, land theft, and genocide. From sea to shining sea, the native nations were decimated and dispossessed. The survivors herded into concentration camps. It was God's will. The genocidal policy reached its peak under President Andrew Jackson. Its ruthlessness was best articulated by Army General Thomas Jessup, who in 1836 wrote, "The country can be rid of them only by exterminating them." Native people are still here. Today, there is growing support for their movements, such as the campaign to abolish Columbus Day and replace it with Indigenous Peoples Day. The Dakota Access Pipeline resistance, led by the Standing Rock Sioux, was joined by many non-Native allies. The action, though unsuccessful, captured the imagination of people everywhere. The struggle for Indigenous rights continues. Our guest today is Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. She's been active in the indigenous movement for more than four decades and is known for her commitment to social justice issues. She's the author of An Indigenous People's History of the United States, winner of the American Book Award. She spoke in Santa Fe, New Mexico, at an event organized by the Lannan Foundation. And now, Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz.
I want to acknowledge that we are present on the unceded traditional territory of the Tewa people's towns and farms, which were brutally invaded and occupied, the people's lives disrupted and displaced in 1607, when the Spanish established their first proclaimed center of dominance in this area. This is also the central site of perhaps the most important liberation movement and revolution in North America, if not the world. This was the 1680 All-Indian Pueblo Revolution, which occurred a century before the future and present colonizer, the United States of America, even existed. That revolutionary spirit is the primary means by which the indigenous peoples of New Mexico and actually the whole Southwest have continued through the past three centuries, and they are the future of this place. I want to say a few words about that 12-year revolution of the 1680s. As a doctoral student in history at UCLA in 1974, I wrote my dissertation on the history of land tenure in New Mexico from pre-colonial times to the present, which became my book, Roots of Resistance. And the template for my research and writing on settler colonialism and its inseparable offspring, attempted genocide. So I owe much to the people and the place that we are in. The Pueblo Revolution brought the Spanish colony to a quick end in 1680. Some years, at least 20, perhaps much longer, of organization produced a unified offensive on the part of all but a few southern pueblos. Remember, there were dozens and dozens of pueblos then, not 19 or 21. There were 90 at first. They were reduced in population and numbers during Spanish colonization. But this unified offensive of the pueblos included the Hopi, of course, and the Zuni to the west, as well as Apache, Navajo, and Ute allies. Many low in the Spanish caste hierarchy, African, mestizo, and indigenous servants living in the servant sector of the Santa Fe Barrio del Anaco joined the revolt. The entire population of settlers, priests, and military were forced into exile to El Paso, where they planned a return, which took place again violently in 1692. And as you know, this is called La Entrada, but it was much more than an entrance. And it is officially celebrated right here in Santa Fe, and there are monuments and plaques that present the people who conquered once again as heroes, as heroic. So why did the Spanish colonizers believe they had the right to appropriate the lands of peoples over 5,000 miles and across a great ocean from Spain? Indeed, how did the British, first as colonizers along the Atlantic shore, then as Anglo-Americans forming their own empire from sea to shining sea? And why is this a continuing current event and not just history? This brings me to the doctrine of discovery. In 1982, the government of Spain and the Holy See, that's the Vatican, which is a non-voting state member of the United Nations, so that's a state that's 1 square mile with no population. So if you wonder why a native nation can be a member of the United Nations, just look at the Vatican. Why not? So Spain and the Holy See proposed to the United Nations General Assembly that the year 1992 be celebrated in the United Nations as an encounter, an encuentro, between Europe and the indigenous peoples of the Americas, a commemoration that would honor Europeans for having brought the gifts of civilization and Christianity to the peoples of the Western Hemisphere. I was sitting in the non-governmental gallery. We had just started our work at the UN 5 years before that, and still learning. We didn't know much about headquarters. We've been doing it at the UN Human Rights Center in Geneva, Switzerland. So I was trying to monitor these meetings to see how things worked. And so I was just taking notes about tedious parliamentary disputes, and I was almost nodding off when I was jolted out of my boredom. I felt panic, helpless to do anything that wouldn't get me ousted from UN headquarters permanently. But then after a few minutes of the Norway and Irish delegates teasing each other that their own ancestors had actually been the first to discover North America, with other European and North American diplomats heartily laughing, all of the African diplomats scattered around the meeting room, seated in alphabetical order by their nation's names, rose in unison. So in other words, of course, they're all black, African. And it was just amazing. I don't know how, this was before texting and the internet or cell phones. I'm not sure how they communicated, but they did in that 5 minutes or so. And they all rose up at one time and walked out. So the jesting and laughter stopped, and the befuddled Europeans and Euro-Americans looked around at each other in confusion. One saying into a live mic, "What does Columbus have to do with Africa?" What indeed? A recess was declared. An hour later, the meeting reconvened, and the African group's chosen spokesperson delivered an impassioned statement condemning any proposal that would celebrate the onset of European colonialism, genocide, and the transatlantic slave trade in the halls of the United Nations. Which was established, as they pointed out, for the purpose of decolonization. So the doctrine of discovery had reared its head in the wrong place. The resolution was dead, but it was not the end of efforts by Spain. And remember, this is not fascist Franco Spain, this is Democratic Socialist Party Spain. The Vatican and others in the West, particularly the Reagan-Bush administrations, to make the quincentennial a cause for celebration. But it was a failed endeavor ultimately, thanks to the powerful solidarity of the world's indigenous and oppressed peoples, along with growing European and Euro-American allies. So as I said, only 5 years before the incident in the UN General Assembly, the Indigenous Peoples of the Americas Conference at the United Nations Geneva, Switzerland headquarters had proposed that 1992 be designated as the United Nations Year of Mourning for the onset of colonialism, African slavery, and attempted genocide of the Indigenous Peoples of the Americas. And that October 12th be designated as the UN International Day of the World's Indigenous Peoples. Although Indigenous peoples want a designated United Nations day, year, and even a decade, the compromise was to not designate, the compromise with the European, US, and some Latin American still dictatorships, not to designate October 12th, rather August 9th as the UN Day of World's Indigenous Peoples, 1993, not 1992, as the UN Year for Indigenous Peoples, and 1994 to 2004 as the UN Decade for Indigenous Peoples. Actually, those decades have been repeated. We're now in the third decade for the World's Indigenous Peoples. UN. However, that year's Nobel Peace Prize was bestowed upon Guatemalan K'iche Mayan leader Rigoberta Menchú. And it was announced in Oslo on October 12, 1992. A decision that infuriated the Spanish government and the Vatican, who withdrew their ambassadors for a time. And in Rigoberta's speech at the Nobel ceremony accepting the prize, she accepted it not for herself, but on behalf of the world's indigenous peoples, and was subsequently appointed UN Honorary Ambassador for Indigenous Peoples, a position she holds to this day. So what is the doctrine of discovery? According to this medieval canon law, European Christian monarchies acquired title to the lands they discovered, and indigenous inhabitants lost their natural right to that land after Christian Europeans had arrived and claimed it. Under this legalistic cover for theft, European and Euro-American wars of conquest and settler colonialism in the Western Hemisphere devastated indigenous nations and communities, ripping their territories away from them and transforming the land into private property or real estate, along with another form of private property, enslaved African bodies. In the United States, most of that land ended up in the hands of land speculators, who were also slavers and agribusiness operators, called plantations, such as most of the U.S. founding fathers, so-called, and most of the U.S. presidents and other government and military officials up to the Civil War. Arcane as it may seem, the doctrine of discovery remains the basis for U.S. federal laws still in effect that control indigenous people's lives and destinies, maintaining a regimen of suffocating settler colonialism under the color of law. So from the mid-15th century to the mid-20th century, most of the non-European world was colonized under the doctrine of discovery. This is the first principle of international law that Christian European monarchies promulgated to legitimize the investigating, mapping, and claiming lands belonging to non-Christian peoples outside of Europe. It originated in a papal bull issued in 1455 that permitted the Portuguese monarchy to seize West Africa for slave raiding. Following Columbus's infamous exploratory voyage in 1492, sponsored by the king and queen of the infant Spanish state, another papal bull extended similar permission to Spain. Disputes between the Portuguese and Spanish monarchies led to the papal-initiated Treaty of Tordesillas in 1494. Which, besides dividing the globe equally between the two Iberian empires, clarified that only non-Christian lands fell under the discovery doctrine. So this doctrine, on which all European states relied, originated with the arbitrary and unilateral establishment of the Iberian monarchy's exclusive rights under Christian canon law to colonize foreign peoples. And this right was later seized and absorbed, usually explicitly, if not by common law, by Protestant Christian European monarchical colonizing projects as well. But not only monarchies. Following the revolution that overthrew the monarchy, the French Republic applied the doctrine of discovery to legalize its 19th and 20th century settler colonialist projects in North Africa, Southeast Asia, and the South Pacific, as did the anti-monarchy independent United States when it continued the settler colonial project of North America, begun but then halted by the British monarchy in 1754. Indeed, the populist settler colonialism of those republics, as well as the late Spanish settler colonies, Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, and Chile, when they won independence and became republics, proved to be the most insidious, including genocidal policies, which in terms of the 1948 Genocide Convention includes forcibly removing children from the group, forcibly preventing births within the group, creating conditions of life that make the group's continued existence impossible, destroying the group's means of subsistence, forced removals or ethnic cleansing, and other acts such as killing that constitute genocide in international law. Indicating the intentions of the newly independent United States, in 1792, Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson asserted that the doctrine of discovery developed by European states was international law, applicable to the new U.S. government as well. Codifying the doctrine of discovery as domestic law in 1823, the U.S. Supreme Court issued three decisions concerning the Cherokee Nation in Georgia. Writing for the majority, Chief Justice John Marshall held that the doctrine of discovery had been an established principle of European law and of English law in effect in British North American colonies, and was also the law of the United States. The court defined the exclusive property rights that a European country acquired by dint of discovery. Quote, Marshall writing, "Discovery gave title to the United States government, by whose subjects or by whose authority it was made, against all other European governments, which title might be consummated by possession. Therefore, European and Euro-American discoverers had gained real property rights in the lands of indigenous peoples by merely planting a flag. Of course, they were and still are met with resistance by the peoples whose land they claim. The court held that the indigenous rights to complete sovereignty, and quote, as independent nations were necessarily diminished. Indigenous peoples could continue to live on the land by grace of the federal government, but title resided with the United States Republic. And of course, this came to be called trust, the trust relationship, or the trust doctrine, which still exists. Soon it turned out that the indigenous people in question who brought the cases to the Supreme Court, the Cherokee Nation and the state of Georgia, were not allowed to remain in their ancestral territory. And Cherokee citizens were forced to march 1,500 miles on foot through an abnormally cold winter, during which half their number died of exposure, starvation, and disease. What the Cherokee people call to this day the Trail of Tears. Already the Muscogee peoples had been deported from Alabama and Mississippi, and by 1850, all the other indigenous peoples east of the Mississippi had been forcibly relocated to Indian Territory west of the Mississippi, which comprised what is now Oklahoma, all of Oklahoma, and part of Kansas and Arkansas. Parallel to and enabled by this ethnic cleansing was the rise of the Cotton Kingdom in the Mississippi Valley and the industrial forced breeding of enslaved Africans in the older slaver states. The foundation and birth of United States capitalism, burrowed into and destroying indigenous sacred land and African sacred bodies as exchange commodities and the source of wealth that built the richest nation, state, and largest and deadliest military in human history, the United States of America. So the doctrine of discovery, at least in the United States, is so taken for granted that very few people even know it exists as a fundamental element of United States law. Although we do know that the U.S. purports to be a nation of laws, we don't iterate this particular one in law schools or in conversation. The doctrine of discovery is rarely mentioned in any historical or legal texts, although the Marshall Court Cherokee decisions are regularly the introduction to constitute U.S. constitutional law after Marbury. Yet the doctrine of discovery is the legal basis upon which the United States government controls indigenous nations whose territories it claims under a continuing colonial system. The doctrine of discovery was once again invoked and validated in the 2005 U.S. Supreme Court case, City of Sherrill versus Oneida Nation of Indians, in which the 1820s U.S. Supreme Court decisions were cited as precedent for denying the Oneida Nation the land claim in this case. Significantly, it was a unanimous decision with the most liberal judge on the bench, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, writing the decision. The United Nations 2007 Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples specifically repudiates the doctrine of discovery, as has the World Court in the case of the Western Sahara. This is actually a prerequisite in the United States because it's codified in law. It's more common law in Latin America. This is the first step toward indigenous decolonization. 3 years ago, I published a history of the United States titled An Indigenous People's History of the United States, which has found a wide audience and has been adopted in many public and private middle and high schools, as well as colleges and universities and countless community and church reading groups. The most frequent question readers ask after reading this book is, why hasn't it been written before? Why hasn't this book been written before? I'm really flattered by that question because it's the one I ask about texts that deeply move me. At the same time that the information or argument or story is new to me and seems like a revelation, it also seems that it was already hidden in the recesses of my brain or heart, a truth actually also embedded in our subconsciousness. But why hasn't this book been written before? We believe we don't suffer academic censorship in the United States, but we do. Rather than being mandated by the government, professional historians self-censor in response to institutionalized policing of the parameters of what's acceptable and what will be marginalized. A broad consensus reached by the U.S. history profession's elite, along with school textbook standards made by states, namely in the last 20, 30 years, Texas, plus the graduate history students' desire to complete the doctorate as easily as possible and start a successful career, and then to get tenure. The civil rights movement of the 1950s and 1960s, and along with the powerful Native, Chicano, Puerto Rican, anti-war, cultural, countercultural, women's liberation, and gay, lesbian, and trans movements broke down the existing consensus and created a window of opportunity that institutionalized revisions through the bottom-up creation of Black, Native, Chicano, and gender studies. But that devolved into a kind of multiculturalism supporting the narrative of diversity and contributions to the greatness of the United States. In achieving a new consensus, the new narrative had to ignore Native issues of sovereignty and territorial rights and treaties, rather twisting the inclusion of indigeneity as a racial discrimination question rather than a question of sovereign nations living under settler colonialism. One of my favorite writers, late writers, William Burroughs, narrator, in his 1984 novel, which I highly recommend, The Place of Dead Roads, observes that, quote, people are not bribed to shut up about what they know, they're bribed not to find out. This is particularly true in the writing of U.S. history, my profession. It's not a free speech issue, but one of asking questions that challenge the core of the scripted narrative. Historians are validated to the extent that they remain guardians of the United States origin narrative, with various tweaks to adjust to demands of the excluded to prevent revolutions. Even those flawed advances are currently in retreat. And U.S. gun violence and endless wars are endemic. Various polls show that even the educated general public doesn't know basic facts about the structure of the U.S. government, the Constitution, the rights of states, and the division of powers. Yet there is a widespread acceptance of the greatness and goodness of the United States, along with the extreme mistrust of government, except for the military.
You're listening to Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. and Indigenous Peoples' History. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can get CDs of this program and her book, An Indigenous Peoples' History of the United States, by calling us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. We can go online or...
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Aubriana. That microphone sounds really loud. Let me turn it down. There we go. Hopefully that's a little bit better, I think. Yeah, levels look good. My name is Aubriana. You are listening to Storytime. I finally officially changed my name on our website. And this is WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Today we are going to be resuming where we left off on Winnie the Pooh. We were in the middle of, I believe, let me check this chapter here. What chapter number were we on? We were in chapter 7, where the gang, you know, Pooh and Owl, and I believe it was Owl, and Christopher Robin and Piglet were trying to capture Kanga's kid. So we'll be finishing that chapter and then moving on to chapter 8. And we'll see how far we get into chapter 8. All right, go ahead and switch to some, we'll do a crackling fireplace today. I think that sounds pretty peaceful. All right. Okay, so we'll start here with Kanga saying, "Well, we must be getting home. Goodbye, Pooh." And in three large jumps, she was gone. Pooh looked after her as she went. "I wish I could jump like that," he thought. "Some can and some can't. That's how it is." But there were moments when Piglet wished that Kanga couldn't. Often, when he had a long walk home through the forest, he wished that he were a bird. But now he thought jerkily to himself at the bottom of Kanga's pocket. "If this is flying, I shall never really take to it." And as he went up in the air, he said, "Ooh," and as he came down, he said, "Ow." And he was saying, "Ooh, ow, ooh, ow," and all the way to Kanga's house. Of course, as soon as Kanga unbuttoned her pocket, she saw what had happened. Just for a moment, she thought she was frightened, but then she knew she wasn't, for she, quote, felt quite sure that Christopher Robin would never let any harm happen to Roo. So she said to herself, "If they are having a joke with me, I will have a joke with them." "Now then, Roo dear," she said as she took Piglet out of her pocket. "Bedtime." "Aha," said Piglet, as well as he could in his terrifying journey. But it wasn't a very good aha, and Kanga didn't seem to understand what it meant. "Bath first," said Kanga in a cheerful voice. "Aha," said Piglet again, looking around anxiously for the others. But the others weren't there. Rabbit was playing with Baby Roo in his own house and feeling more fond of him every minute, and Pooh, who had decided to be a Kanga, was still at the sandy place on top of the forest practicing jumps. "I am not at all sure," said Kanga in a thoughtful voice, "that it wouldn't be a good idea to have a cold bath this evening. Would you like that, Roo, dear?" Piglet, who had never been really fond of baths, shuddered a long, indignant shudder and said, in as brave a voice as he could, "Kanga, I see that the time has come to speak plainly. Funny little Roo, said Kanga, as she got the bathwater ready. I am not Roo, said Piglet loudly. I am Piglet. Yes, dear, yes, said Kanga soothingly. And imitating Piglet's voice, too. So clever of him, she went on, as she took a large bar of yellow soap out of the cupboard. What will he be doing next? Can't you see? Shouted Piglet. Haven't you got eyes? Look at me. I am looking, Roo dear, said Kanga, rather severely. And you know what I told you yesterday about making faces. If you go on making faces like Piglets, you will grow up to look like Piglet. And then, how sorry you will be. Now then, into the bath, and don't let me have to speak to you about it again. Before he knew where he was, Piglet was in the bath, and Kanga was scrubbing him firmly with a large, leathery flannel. Ow! Cried Piglet. Let me out! I'm Piglet! Don't open your mouth, dear, or the soap gets in, said Kanga. There! What did I tell you? You did it on purpose, sputtered Piglet as soon as he could speak again, and then accidentally had another mouthful of lathery flannel. That's right, dear. Don't say anything, said Kanga. In another minute, Piglet was out of the bath and being rubbed dry with the towel. Now, said Kanga, there's your medicine and then bed. What medicine? Said Piglet. To make you grow big and strong, dear. We don't want you to grow up and small and weak like Piglet, do you? Well then, at that moment there was a knock at the door. Come in, said Kanga, and in came Christopher Robin. Christopher Robin! Christopher Robin! Cried Piglet. Tell Kanga who I am. She keeps saying I'm Roo, and I'm not Roo, am I? Christopher Robin looked at him very carefully and shook his head. You can't be Roo, he said, because I've just seen Roo playing in Rabbit's house. Well, said Kanga, fancy that. Fancy my making a mistake like that. There you are, said Piglet. I told you so. I'm Piglet. Christopher Robin shook his head again. Oh, you're not Piglet, he said. I know Piglet well, and he's quite a different color. Piglet began to say that this was because he had just had a bath, and then he thought perhaps he wouldn't say that, as he opened his mouth to say something else, Kanga slipped the medicine spoon in, and then patted him on the back, and told him that it was really a quite nice taste when he got used to it. I knew it wasn't Piglet. I wonder who it can be. Perhaps it's some relation of Pooh's, said Christopher Robin. What about a nephew or uncle or something? Kanga agreed that this was probably what it was, and said that they would have to call it by some name. I shall call it Poodle, said Christopher Robin. Henry Poodle, for short. And just when it was decided, Henry Poodle wriggled out of Kanga's arms and jumped to the ground. To his great joy, Christopher Robin had left the door open. Never had Henry Poodle Piglet run so fast as he ran then, and he didn't stop running until he had got quite close to his house. But when he was 100 yards away, he stopped running and rolled the rest of the way home so as to get his own nice, comfortable color again. So Kanga and Roo stayed in the forest, and every Tuesday, Roo spent the day with his great friend Rabbit, and every Tuesday, Kanga spent the day with her great friend Pooh, teaching him to jump. And every Tuesday, Piglet spent the day with his friend, Christopher Robin. So they were all happy again. And that's the end of Chapter 7. If you haven't by now, go ahead and get yourself a snack. I have a nice sparkling water here. And before this, I had a granola bar, you know, a little afternoon snack. You have a bit of time, go ahead, and then, well, actually not a little bit of time. We're going to go ahead and get started on Chapter 8 right now, in which Christopher Robin leads an expedition to the North Pole. Alright. One fine day, Pooh had stumped up to the top of the forest to see if his friend Christopher Robin was interested in bears at all. At breakfast that morning, a simple meal of marmalade spread lightly over a honeycomb or two, he had suddenly thought of a new song. It began like this: "Sing ho for the life of a bear." When he had got as far as this, he scratched his head and thought to himself, "That's a very good start for a song, but what about the second line?" He tried to sing ho 3 times, but it didn't seem to help. Perhaps it would be better, he thought, if I sang hi for the life of a bear. So he sang it, but it wasn't. "Very well then," he said, "I shall sing that first line twice, and perhaps if I sing it very quickly, I shall find myself singing the third and fourth lines before I have time to think of them, and that will be a good song. Now then, sing ho for the life of a bear, sing ho for the life of a bear. I don't much mind if it rains or snows, 'cause I've got a lot of honey on my nice new nose. I don't much care if it snows or thaws, 'cause I've got a lot of honey on my nice clean paws. Sing ho for bear, sing ho for poo, and I'll have little something in an hour or two." He was so pleased with this little song that he sang it all the way to the top of the forest. "And if I go on singing it much longer," he thought, "it will be time for the little something, and then the last line won't be true." So he turned it into a hum instead. Christopher Robin was sitting outside his door, putting on his big boots. As soon as he saw the big boots, Pooh knew that an adventure was going to happen, and he brushed the honey off his nose with the back of his paw and spruced himself up as well as he could so as to look ready for anything. "Good morning, Christopher Robin," he called out. "Hello, Pooh Bear. I can't get this boot on." "That's bad," said Pooh. "Do you think you could very kindly lean against me? 'Cause I've been pulling so hard that I fall over backwards." Pooh sat down, dug his feet into the ground, and pushed hard against Christopher Robin's back. And Christopher Robin pushed hard against his, and pulled at his boot until he had it on. "And that's that," said Pooh. "What do we do next?" "We are going on an expedition," said Christopher Robin, as he got up and brushed himself. "Thank you, Pooh." "Going on an expedition?" said Pooh eagerly. "I don't think I've ever been on one of those. Where are we going on this expedition?" "Expedition, silly old bear. It's got an X in it." "Oh," said Pooh. "I know." But he didn't really. "We're going to discover the North Pole." "Oh," said Pooh again. "What is the North Pole?" he asked. "It's just a thing you discover," said Christopher Robin carelessly, not being quite sure himself. "Oh, I see," said Pooh. "Are bears any good at discovering it?" "Of course they are," said Rabbit and Kanga. "Of course they are, and Rabbit and Kanga and all of you. It's an expedition. That's what an expedition means. A long line of everybody. You'd better tell the others to get ready while I see if my gun's all right. And we must all bring provisions." "Bring what?" "Things to eat." "Oh," said Pooh happily. "I thought you said provisions. I'll go and tell them." And he stumped off. The first person he met was Rabbit. "Hello, Rabbit," he said. "Is that you?" "Let's pretend it isn't," said Rabbit, "and see what happens." "I've got a message for you." "I'll give it to him." "We're going on an expedition with Christopher Robin." "What is it when we're on it?" "A sort of boat, I think," said Pooh. "Oh, that sort." "Yes, and we're going to discover a pole or something. Or was it a mole? Anyhow, we're going to discover it." "We are we?" said Rabbit. "Yes, and we've got to bring things to eat with us, in case we want to eat them. So now I'm going down to Piglet's. Tell Kanga, will you?" He left Rabbit and hurried down to Piglet's house. The piglet was sitting on the ground at the door of his house, blowing happily at a dandelion, and wondering whether it would be this year, next year, sometime, or never. He had just discovered that it would be never, and was trying to remember what it was, and hoping that it wasn't anything nice, when Pooh came up. "Oh, Piglet," said Pooh excitedly. "We're going on an expedition, all of us. With things to eat. To discover something." "To discover what?" said Piglet anxiously. "Oh, just something. Nothing fierce?" Christopher Robin didn't say anything about fierce. He just said it had an X. "It isn't their necks, I mind," said Piglet earnestly. It's their teeth. But if Christopher Robin is coming, I don't mind anything. In a little while, they were all ready at the top of the forest, and the expedition started. First came Christopher Robin and Rabbit, then Piglet and Pooh, then Kanga, with Roo in her pocket and Owl, then Eeyore, and at the end, in a long line, all Rabbit's friends and relations. I didn't ask them, said Rabbit carelessly. They just came. They always do. They can march at the end, after Eeyore. What I say, said Eeyore, is that it's unsettling. I didn't want to come on this expo, what Pooh said. I only came to oblige. But here I am, and if I am the end of the expo, what we're talking about, then let me be the end. But if every time I want to sit down for a little rest, I have to brush away half a dozen of Rabbit's smaller friends and relations first, then this isn't an expo whatever it is at all. It's simply a confused noise. That's what I say. I see what Eeyore means, said Owl. If you ask me, I'm not asking anybody, said Eeyore. I'm just telling everybody. We can look for the North Pole, or we can play Here We Go Gathering Nuts in May with the end part of an ant's nest. It's all the same to me. There was a shout from the top of the line. Come on, called Christopher Robin. Come on, said Pooh and Piglet. Come on, called Owl. We're starting, said Rabbit. I must go. And he hurried off to the front of the expedition with Christopher Robin. All right, said Eeyore, we're going, only don't blame me. So off they all went to discover the pole, and as they walked, they chattered to each other of this and that, all except Pooh, who was making up a song. This is the first verse, he said to Piglet, when he was ready with it. First verse of what? My song. Which one? Well, if you listen, Piglet, you'll hear it. How do you know I'm not listening? Pooh couldn't answer that one, so he began to sing. They all went off to discover the pole, Owl and Piglet and Rabbit and all. It's a thing you discover, as I've been told, by Owl and Piglet and Rabbit and all. Eeyore, Christopher, Robin, and Pooh, and Rabbit's relations all went too. And where the pole was, none of them knew. Sing hey for Owl and Rabbit and all. Hush, said Christopher Robin, turning to Pooh. We're just coming to a dangerous place. Hush, said Pooh, turning round quickly to Piglet. Hush, said Piglet to Kanga. Hush, said Kanga to Owl, while Roo said hush several times to himself very quietly. Hush, said Owl to Eeyore. Hush, said Eeyore in a terrible voice to all Rabbit's friends and relations. And hush, they said hastily to each other down the line until it got to the last one of all. And the last and smallest friend and relation was so upset to find that the whole expedition was saying hush to him that he buried himself head downwards in a crack in the ground and stayed there for 2 days until the danger was over, and then went home in a great hurry and lived quietly with his aunt ever afterwards. His name was Alexander Beetle. They had come to a stream, which twisted and tumbled between high rocky banks, and Christopher Robin saw at once how dangerous it was. It's just the place, he explained, for an ambush. What sort of bush? Whispered Piglet to Pooh to Piglet. A gorse bush? My dear Piglet, said Owl in his superior way, don't you know what an ambush is? Owl, said Piglet, looking round at him severely, Pooh's whisper was a very perfectly private whisper, and there was no need to. An ambush, said Owl, is a sort of surprise. So is a gorse bush sometimes, said Pooh. An ambush, as I was about to explain to Pooh, said Piglet, is a sort of surprise. If people jump out at you suddenly, that's an ambush, said Owl. It's an ambush, Pooh, when people jump out at you suddenly, explained Piglet. Pooh, who now knew what an ambush was, said that a gorse bush had sprung at him suddenly one day when he fell off of a tree, and he had taken 6 days to get all the prickles out of him. We are not talking about gorse bushes, said Owl, a little crossly. Well, I am, said Pooh. They were climbing very cautiously upstream now. Going from rock to rock, after they had gone a little way, they came to a place where the banks widened out at each side, so that on each side of the water there was a level strip of grass on which they could sit down and rest. As soon as he saw this, Christopher Robin called, Halt! And they all sat down and rested. I think, said Christopher Robin, that we ought to eat all our provisions now, so that we shan't have so much to carry. Eat all our what? said Pooh. All that we've brought, said Piglet, getting to work. That's a good idea, and he got to work too. Have you all got something? Asked Christopher Robin with his mouth full. All except me, said Eeyore. As usual, he looked round at them in his melancholy way. I suppose none of you are sitting on a thistle, by chance? I believe I am, said Pooh. Ow, he got up and looked behind him. Yes, I was, I thought so. Thank you, Pooh, if you've quite finished with it. He moved across to Pooh's place and began to eat. It don't do them any good, you know, sitting on them, he went on, as he looked up, munching. Takes all the life out of them. Remember that another time, all of you. A little consideration, a little thought for others makes all the difference. As soon as he had finished his lunch, Christopher Robin whispered to Rabbit, and Rabbit said, yes, yes, of course. And they walked a little way up the stream together. I didn't want the others to hear, said Christopher Robin. Quite so, said Rabbit, looking important. I wonder. It's only, Rabbit, I suppose you don't know. What does the North Pole look like? Well, said Rabbit, stroking his whiskers. Now you're asking me. I did know once, only I've sort of forgotten, said Christopher Robin carelessly. It's a funny thing, said Rabbit, but I've sort of forgotten too. Although I did know once. I suppose it's just a pole stuck in the ground? Sure to be a pole, said Rabbit, because of calling it a pole, and if it's a pole, well, I should think it would be sticking in the ground, shouldn't you? Because there'd be nowhere else to stick it. Yes, that's what I thought. The only thing, said Rabbit, is where is it sticking? That's what we're looking for, said Christopher Robin. They went back to the others. Piglet was lying on his back, sleeping peacefully. Roo was washing his face and paws in the stream, while Kanga explained to everybody proudly that this was the first time he had ever washed his face himself. An owl was telling Kanga an interesting anecdote full of long words like encyclopedia and rhododendron, to which Kanga wasn't listening. I don't hold with all this washing, grumbled Eeyore. This modern behind-the-ears nonsense, what do you think, Pooh? Well, said Pooh, I think. But we shall never know what Pooh thought, for there came a sudden squeak from Roo, a splash and a loud cry of alarm from Kanga. So much for washing, said Eeyore. Roo's fallen in, cried Rabbit. Then he and Christopher Robin came rushing down to the rescue. Look at me swimming, squeaked Roo from the middle of the pool, and was hurried down a waterfall into the next pool. Are you all right, Roo, dear? Called Kanga anxiously. Yes, said Roo. Look at me and he went down over the next waterfall into another pool. Everybody was doing something to help. Piglet, wide awake suddenly, was jumping up and down and making ooh, I say, noises. Owl was explaining that in a sudden case of some sudden and temporary immersion, the important thing was to keep the head above water. Kanga was jumping along the bank saying, are you sure you're all right, Roo, dear? To which Roo, from whatever pool he was in at the moment, answered, look at me swimming. Eeyore had turned around and hung his tail over the first pool into which Roo fell, and with his back to the accident, grumbling quietly to himself, saying, all this watching, but catch on to my tail, little Roo, and you'll be all right. And Christopher Robin and Rabbit came hurrying past Eeyore and were calling out to the others in front of them. All right, Roo, I'm coming, said Christopher Robin. Get something across the stream lower down, some of you fellows, called Rabbit. But Pooh was getting something. Two pools below Roo, he was standing with a long pole in his paws, and Kanga came up and took one end of it, and between them, they held it across the lower part of the pool. And Roo, still bubbling proud, said, look at me swimming, and drifted up against it and climbed out. Did you see me swimming? Squeaked Roo excitedly, while Kanga scolded him and rubbed him down. Pooh, did you see me swimming? That's called swimming, what I was doing. Rabbit, did you see what I was doing? Swimming. Hello, Piglet. I say, Piglet, what do you think I was doing? Swimming. Christopher Robin, did you see me? But Christopher Robin wasn't listening. He was looking at Pooh. Pooh, where did you find that pole? Pooh looked at the pole in his hands. I just found it, he said. I thought it ought to be useful. I just picked it up. Pooh, said Christopher Robin, solemnly. The expedition is over. You have found the North Pole. Oh, said Pooh. Eeyore was sitting with his tail in the water when they all got back to him. Tell Roo to be quick, somebody, he said. My tail's getting cold. I don't want to mention it, but I just mention it. I don't want to complain, but there it is. My tail's cold. Here I am, squeaked Roo. Oh, there you are. Did you see me swimming? Eeyore took his tail out of the water and swished it from side to side. As I expected, he said. Lost all feeling. Numbed it. That's what it's done. Numbed it. Well, as long as nobody minds, I suppose it's all right. Poor old Eeyore, I'll dry it for you, said Christopher Robin. And he took out his handkerchief and dried it up. Thank you, Christopher Robin. You're the only one who seems to understand about tails. They don't think. That's what's the matter with some of these others. They've no imagination. A tail isn't a tail to them. It's just a little bit extra at the back. Never mind, Eeyore, said Christopher Robin. Is that better? It's feeling more like a tail, perhaps. It belongs again, if you know what I mean. Hello, Eeyore, said Pooh, coming up to them with his pole. Hello, Pooh. Thank you for asking, but I shall be able to use it again in a day or two. Used what? Said Pooh. What are we talking about? I wasn't talking about anything, said Pooh, looking puzzled. My mistake again. I thought you were saying how sorry you were about my tail being all numb. And could you do anything to help? No, said Pooh. That wasn't me, he said. He thought for a little and then suggested helpfully, perhaps it was somebody else? Well, thank him for me when you see him. Pooh looked anxiously at Christopher Robin. Pooh's found the North Pole, said Christopher Robin. Isn't that lovely? Pooh looked modestly down. Is that it? Said Eeyore. Yes, said Christopher Robin. Is that what we were looking for? Yes, said Pooh. Oh, well, anyhow, it didn't rain, said. They stuck the pole in the ground, and Christopher Robin tied a message to it. North Pole discovered by Pooh. Pooh found it. They all went home again, and I think, but I'm not quite sure, that Roo had a hot bath and went straight to bed. But Pooh went back to his own house, and feeling very proud of what he had done, had a little something to revive himself. That's the end of chapter 8. Next week we'll get to chapter 9, in which Piglet is entirely surrounded by water. Pretty interesting title there. But until then, I will leave you with some Mice on Venus from the Minecraft soundtrack. I hope everyone has a great rest of their week. This is Aubriana on WRCT Pittsburgh, and this was Storytime. Thank you so much. Thank you.
another dimension. A dimension not only of sight and of sound, but also of mind. This is a dimension that few people enter, and from which even fewer return. There is a signpost up ahead. Your next stop, WRCT 88.3 FM Stereo.